From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. There's an obesity epidemic going on in America, but that word epidemic, that word implies that there's a cure, a medically based treatment plan, a pill, a shot, something that can stop the epidemic. Truth is, there's very little that doctors, public health officials, or the multi-billion dollar dieting industry have done so far that slowed the rising obesity rate, which is why one reporter suggests it's time to rethink what we know and presume about obesity, its causes, its consequences, and its correlation with wellness. And if so, what would that mean when American culture is as weight-obsessed, as fat-shaming as ever? This hour on Point, Rethinking Obesity. And you can join the conversation. Have you struggled with your weight? Do you get the help you need in the doctor's office? Or do you feel shamed about your body shape, your size, even there? What is stopping us from getting a handle on the obesity epidemic? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining me now from Seattle is Michael Hobbs. He's reporter at The Huffington Post and author of a new article entitled Everything You Know About Obesity Is Wrong. We've got a link to it at onpointradio.org. Michael Hobbs, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. First of all, I wonder if we could actually start off with your personal story that you tell in your piece about weight in your own life and amongst your family members and why you really wanted to write about obesity now.
I mean, I know journalists aren't really supposed to say this, but I've had a chip on my shoulder about this issue for my entire life because growing up, my mother struggled with her weight her entire life and my entire life. And what I saw was in public the way that people treated her was, you know, people in restaurants or people on public transit. Her friends would make comments about her. Family members of ours would make comments about her. And the message was always that she needed to be trying harder. She was unhealthy. And then I would see in private the way that she actually lived. She was swimming 5 times a week. She was biking everywhere. She would make us meatloaf, the whole family, and then she'd sit there and she'd eat a bowl of carrots next to us. She was always on a diet. She was always trying. And even to a 5-year-old, that just seemed unfair to me, that everyone is telling this person that she's unhealthy, that she needs to change, but she's basically already doing everything that the world is telling her to do. And no matter what she's doing, they're always telling her to try harder. And once you look into the data on this, it's very similar across the country, that all of the things that we know about obesity are much more complex when you actually live them than they seem when you read news articles about them.
Well, so let me just ask one more question about your mom. I mean, you just talked about all the things that she was doing to be a healthy person, but the response, the reactions that she was getting from the world around her. I mean, how did those reactions affect her?
I mean, it made her, you know, she talked to me for this article. The first time we ever talked about her weight in detail was for this article, once I had, you know, looked at all the research and things. And she said that it wasn't that she got bullied necessarily. It wasn't that it happened all that often that people shouted things at her. It was more that she waited to do things because she thought fat people couldn't do them. So she did her master's degree when she was 38. She did her PhD at 55. And I never knew all the ways that she was putting off her life because she thought being a fat person would discredit her, that people wouldn't take her seriously.
Mm. You know, also in your article, you write about how you've never had a story where so many of your sources broke down into tears and cried.
Yeah, I talked to one guy who, you know, if he looks at himself in the mirror long enough for 5 or 10 minutes, he'll start to cry. His wife doesn't know that he struggles with this. His wife doesn't know that he has binge eating problems, that he thinks about this all the time, that if he catches a glimpse of himself on like a security camera at a department store, it will ruin his entire day. He doesn't feel comfortable talking about this stuff. And it is interesting, you know, how obsessed all of us are with our weight, with our body image and our looks. And yet it isn't something most of us feel very comfortable talking about. All these deep insecurities and these deep fears that we have about the way that we look and the judgments that we make about how other people look. And it's just this giant iceberg underneath us that we're all thinking about, but we're not talking about very much.
Right. And isn't it ironic that we may not be able to honestly talk about our or healthfully talk about our own struggles with weight when we live in a society that's really, really weight obsessed? And I feel like we're getting signals all the time everywhere about what is healthy and what isn't regarding, you know, our weight.
And also, I mean, there's also this weird double standard, too, that since I started working on this article, I started noticing the way that skinny people are allowed to talk about food. You know, oh, I shouldn't be having this second slice of cake, or, oh, I was so bad yesterday, or I don't feel like going jogging. And, you know, when you start talking to fat people will say, I would never say things like that out loud. I would never be able to get away with just these kind of cute and fun little quips that skinny people are allowed to make. Whereas when a fat person, when you look like you have bad habits, when people assume that you have some sort of moral failing, they hold you to a completely different standard. And so what that does to fat people is it makes you feel like you're being watched all the time, right? That if somebody brings bagels to a work meeting, you're like, well, do I reach for one and then I'm going to confirm everybody's stereotype? Mm-hmm. Or do I not reach for one and then somebody later is going to be like, oh, are you on a diet? Like, it just gives you the self-awareness that skinny people go through life just not really being aware of the ways that they talk about diet and exercise. But fat people have this really pernicious idea that they have to be a good fatty in public, that otherwise they're going to be judged for their behavior. And in many ways, they're right. People really do judge fat people in a completely different way than they judge skinny people.
Okay. So, Michael, the headline of your story is Everything You Know About Obesity Is Wrong. Now, you know, headlines are always designed to grab people's attention. I get that. but you know, reading through your story, though, that is kind of the attitude that you're taking. So when you say that, like, much of what we presume about obesity is wrong, what do you mean?
Well, I think there's three main facts that are not reflected anywhere in medical practice or in public health. And the first is that weight and health are not synonyms. There's quite a few healthy fat people and there's quite a few unhealthy skinny people. There's these overlapping circles between weight and health, but they're not perfect. The second is that losing weight is almost impossible. 95 to 98% of diets fail, and many people gain back more weight than they lost. And it's really hard on your body and it's hard on your mental health too to lose weight and then gain the weight back slowly. And the third is that fat shaming doesn't work. Telling somebody that they have to lose weight or that their lifespan is shorter or that their knees are going to go out when they're 31, these kinds of things don't make it easier to lose weight. They make it harder. And so if you were designing a medical system and a public health system around those three facts, it would look very different than ours. I mean, we still have doctors constantly telling people to lose weight. I mean, when you talk to fat people, they'll say they go in with an earache, they go in with migraines, they go in with anything, and their doctor says, oh, you need to lose 40 pounds, as if that is imperative for their health and as if that is even possible.
Okay.
And oftentimes, I mean, I spoke to one woman who was in a train derailment, a big accident, and she goes into the ER and the doctor says, how long have you been this big? As if that has anything to do with her dislocated shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have this idea that we sort of have to shame people, losing weight is possible, and that it's this urgent thing that you have to do right now. And none of those things are actually true.
But you do, I mean, I'm going to come back to this point in just in a few minutes, because you do actually mention some of the external factors why doctors may have to talk about weight with patients whenever they come into the clinic, for regardless of what the actual reason for them coming in is. And I'm going to get back to that in a second. But Michael, hang on here for just a second, because I want to bring in another voice into this conversation. Dr. Fatima Cody Stanford joins us now. She's an obesity medicine physician at Massachusetts General Hospital's Weight Center. She's also a professor at Harvard Medical School, and she joins us in the studio. Dr. Stanford, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So Michael is kind of putting out a very big hypothesis by saying just about everything we know, or fundamental presumptions that we have about obesity in America, are wrong. Would you agree with that?
I think that the general public does have this concept that it's all about eating less and exercising more. And if we accomplish those, if we're really, really great at that, then we shouldn't struggle with our weight. So I would say that that's the typical premise. And there are some significant flaws with that assumption. So when patients come to me, I only see patients that have a history of weight struggles. They often have tried many diets. You know, maybe they're on diet number 27 within the last 5 years. And they tell me they've been successful with their weight loss, meaning that they may have lost 100 pounds, but they're coming to me 110 pounds over where they were when they initially started with that diet. And so I think this does speak volumes to what Michael has pointed out, that when the body deprives itself for a significant amount of time, the body compensates for that. So it does what it can to defend that initial cell set point of weight and often rebounds above that. That's what we call weight cycling.
Well, the issue then is the kind of dieting.
Well, I don't believe in dieting altogether. So I think that you can talk to any of my patients, whether they're my pediatric or adult patients, and I never put them on a diet. If we're looking at their food, I might be looking at their food quality. So I'm looking at the consumption of lean protein, whole grains, fruits, vegetables, teaching them how to eat real foods in a way that's maintainable over the course of their lifetime.
Okay, so Michael has presented a lot to us to dig in, and we're going to do that over the course of this hour. But before I go any further, Dr. Stanford, I want to just get, you know, your authoritative take on this. The medical literature shows that there are correlations, though, between excessive weight, between obesity and risk factors, or that it is a risk factor for, you know, some very important and deadly diseases, though, right?
Absolutely. So we call these obesity comorbid conditions or obesity comorbidities. And we know of at least 100 plus affecting every system of our body, whether it be hypertension, type 2 diabetes, obstructive sleep apnea, intracranial idiopathic hypertension. We could just go on and on. So we do know that these conditions are sometimes the derivative of someone having moderate to severe obesity. And so my goal when working with patients is to help solve and or reduce their level of obesity to mitigate some of those problems.
So, I mean, as Michael pointed out, he talked to patients who they would go in for an earache, though, and the doctor would end up talking to them about their weight, and it didn't seem like it made any sense. So are doctors wrong or right to do that, though?
I think it's important for patients to be aware of obesity being a clinical diagnosis. It is a disease that can be treated. I think that we do have treatments that aren't utilized because we're not educated on how to utilize these treatments, either in medical school or in residency. And so that there are treatments available, but often we aren't taught how to use those and how to approach patients in a fashion that's best for them.
Okay. Well, Dr. Fatima Cody Stanford joins us today. She's a professor at Harvard Medical School and an obesity medicine specialist at Massachusetts General Hospital. Michael Hobbs is also with us. He's written a really interesting article in Huffington Post called Everything You Know About Obesity Is Wrong. And Michael, we're going to dig into more about what you've written when we come back from a break. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about maybe rethinking how we approach issues of being overweight and obesity in America. And we're joined today by Michael Hobbs. He's our staff writer at Huffington Post, and he's author of an article titled Everything You Know About Obesity Is Wrong. There's a link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Dr. Fatima Cody Stanford joins us as well. She's an obesity medicine physician at Massachusetts General Hospital Weight Center, and she's with us in our On Point studio here in Boston. Now, Michael, before the break, you were sort of you gave us the top three bullet points of the aspects of obesity that you felt that we kind of collectively misunderstand. So let's dig into some of those a little bit more. Talk to me about the one where you said weight and health are not perfect synonyms, but we oftentimes feel as if they are with people who are struggling with their weight. What do you mean?
Well, first of all, I want to say hi to Fatima because I actually visited her clinic as part of writing this article about a year ago.
So, hi, Michael. Fatima. Good to see you. I was like, we hung out together. It's good to
see you. Yeah, I know.
To
it was really fun.
Absolutely.
And I think, I mean, as Fatima knows, there's a lot of debate in the medical community about what exactly metabolically healthy obesity means, right? And then some studies find that there's a small percentage of fat people with metabolically healthy obesity, and some studies find a much larger percentage. And I actually, you know, Fatima, feel free to disagree with me, but I feel like it doesn't actually matter that we know how difficult weight is to lose, and we know how harmful it is to shame people for their weight. And so if there are big health effects of obesity, I'm not sure that it really helps for, you know, a neurologist to tell somebody, you have to lose 40 pounds before I treat your migraines. I mean, I think for people that do want to lose weight, I think it's really important. You know, I mean, I think it's fine to talk about the health risks. In the same way, you know, I'm a gay man. There are health risks associated with gay people. Gay people are more likely to use illegal drugs. They're more likely to have unsafe sex. It's perfectly fine for my doctor to talk to me about those things. But he needs to talk to me about those things in a healthy and accepting and questioning way, right? Of what are your sexual practices? What are your drug use practices? And not in this way that, hello, and then 2 seconds into the appointment, he says, oh, well, because you're using meth, I think you should stop using meth. I mean, one thing that came away from me from your clinic, Fatima, was the way that you guys had an hour-long appointment with patients and you were really listening to them. And that's something that with primary care providers, a lot of fat patients just never get that luxury of somebody asking them about their habits and listening to what they say and believing them.
Well, a lot of patients, period, will never get that luxury with their primary care physicians. Dr. Stanford, go ahead.
Yeah, so I want to touch on a few points. Number one, I want to remove some of the language or language that I wouldn't use with my patients, which is fat or skinny. I can tell you that patients on the extremes, meaning either very lean or ones that have obesity, often are taken aback by those terms. We do know obesity is a disease process. So I'll say that this patient has either mild, moderate, or severe obesity. So that we know that we're treating the disease and not labeling them by that, because I do think that promotes weight bias and stigma. So I want us to make sure that we don't do that. Now, this idea or concept of metabolic healthy obesity is such that we look at a patient. The patient we know has mild, moderate, or severe obesity, but there's nothing that we're able to define clearly by taking like blood samples or things of that sort that really points to them having any disease pathology. What we're finding is that this term of metabolically healthy obesity is a little bit falling out of favor, because what we're finding is that even in patients where things appear normal on the surface, they do have issues. So for example, I have adolescent patients that we send to weight loss surgery. These are patients that obviously have moderate to severe obesity. And when you look at them, they may have no obesity comorbid conditions at the time of surgery. What we do at the time of operation for most of these patients is we do a liver biopsy. And with that liver biopsy, we're able to determine if the patient has fatty liver disease. Now, if you look at their liver function tests, if you do an ultrasound of their liver, we're finding that it appears is that they don't have liver disease. But when they do that biopsy, we're finding that about 95% of these adolescents that we're sending to surgery actually have fatty liver disease.
95%?
95% of the patients. We just finished a study looking at this. So that shows you that we're not picking up on something in a way that we might in an adult patient.
Can I ask you a question though,
absolutely,
about this? Because I think, you know, there's something that Michael said that really is stuck in my head now, where he was, I think he's pointing out like, But why should a neurologist, though, be talking to someone about their weight when that person's there for a migraine? And you know, I want to relate that to what you just said, Dr. Stanford, because a neurologist isn't going to find evidence of fatty liver disease anyway.
But let's look at what you guys just said. And this is, I'm going to put on my medical hat because that's why you guys have me here. So patients that have obesity have a high likelihood of having migraines. And just coincidentally, many of the drugs that are used to treat migraine headaches also are great for weight loss. So when I find that my patients, and I would say about 50% of my adult patients, have a history of migraine headaches and have obesity, I might concurrently be treating with the medication both disease processes. I'm getting rid of their migraines, they're losing weight, it's a win-win situation. So I would say that their neurologist approaching them, maybe from the lens of neurology, using that migraines as a key place to come in, but we recognize that, remember, we talked about every disease process that we know affects all organ systems. So neurology is one of the very important ones.
Michael, did you want to respond to that?
Well, I mean, the stories that I'm hearing from fat people are not that their neurologists are saying, you know, we have a couple comorbidities, do you mind if we run some tests? The stories that I'm hearing are, we won't run any tests until you lose weight. I mean, I've been hearing from people that their doctors refuse to give them an MRI until they lose weight. Their doctors refuse to give them fertility treatment until they lose weight. I think when we talk about obesity care, we tend to conflate weight loss and the care that fat people get when they go to the doctor. And I think that it's really worthwhile to separate those two things, because not every fat person goes to the doctor seeking to lose weight. A lot of them feel like their life is fine. They feel like their habits are fine. They don't feel like they have to lose weight, or they're already on a plan by themselves with their husband, whatever, trying to lose weight in some other way. All they need is a doctor to treat their earache, right? Mm-hmm. Or if they get in a train accident, they need somebody who's going to be compassionate and who's going to fix their dislocated shoulder. And so I think it's really important that doctors take very seriously this idea that fat people are not getting effective medical care. And a lot of fat people, this shows up in studies too, that fat people avoid going to the doctor because they're afraid that they're going to get shamed for their weight. Or they don't get cancer screenings because they're afraid of what the interaction with the nurse is going to be like. They don't want to be weighed. And I think if you're thinking about effective care, I think it's fine for a neurologist to bring up, hey, you know, based on the research, we have a couple things that are related. Weight might be related to migraines, that kind of thing. But that's not the kinds of interactions that people are having. It's really important to think about how pervasive weight stigma is and how weight does discredit patients with their doctors, oftentimes in specialties that are really only tangentially related to weight.
Dr. Stanford, go ahead.
Yeah, so I do agree that we as physicians overall don't do a great job of approaching patients that struggle with their weight, secondary to our own biases and an adequate education surrounding how to treat patients that have obesity. What we do know, and you do cover this in your article, is that education surrounding obesity, nutrition, physical activity, and medical schools, residency programs throughout the country is minimal at best. I can tell you that there are several organizations working on improving the standards surrounding this issue, because we do know that 40% of the adult population has obesity and 19% of the pediatric patient has obesity, which means that this is by far the most prevalent chronic disease. And so I agree that we do have some work. I would say that if patients are concerned about the care they're getting and if they want dedicated care, I would seek out a fellowship-trained obesity medicine physician like myself, or one that has undergone training and or certification by the American Board of Obesity Medicine.
Can I just jump in here for a second on that? Because if you're living in Boston or Seattle or Chicago or Houston, maybe you can find that. But what if you're living in a rural county that doesn't have that kind of specialist?
I would say that we're doing a really good job. So the American Board of Obesity Medicine has certified 1,200 physicians in obesity in different subspecialties, from neurology to OBGYN to pathology in the recent years. And what you can do is you can go to the American Board of Obesity Medicine site, type in your zip code, and see which doctors are certified in that area. There's no paywall to get through. You can see who is working in the space in your area. But I would agree with Michael that often we do fail the patients, and patients do delay seeking care when they feel as though they're going to receive some type of judgment within the space of medicine in which they're not respected for their weight, and often are not given any actual solutions to help them with their weight struggles.
So, I mean, that sort of feeling of being judged can come from a lot of different places, right? From a physician's own personal conscious or unconscious bias, from, you know, the training that a physician may or may not have had. But Michael, there's something that you brought up in your article that I had literally no idea about, and I want to hear from both you and Dr. Stanford about this. And that is sort of the hidden hand of the insurance company, for example, when physicians are treating patients who have obesity. You wrote about that, and it really opened my eyes. Can you tell us a little bit more?
Yeah, I don't know if you get this with your software, Fatima, but a doctor that I spoke to in Phoenix said that she gets an alert on her electronic medical records system when she's seeing a patient whose BMI is over 30. So when they're classified as obese, she gets an alert that says, ding, ding, this patient is obese. You have to talk to this patient about how to bring their weight down. And she said that what that does is it creates an incentive for her that even if that patient is happy with their weight, even if that patient has perfectly fine habits or they've had an eating disorder before and are not interested in trying to lose weight again, she has to show, she has to document that she has brought up with that patient, oh, you need to bring your weight down. She has to show, she's judged on whether her patients have been basically cajoled into losing weight. And she said that she feels increasingly uncomfortable about this because she's having more and more patients that say, look, I've tried 50 times before. It simply isn't worth the stress for me to try to lose weight again. I will work on my habits, but I'm not interested in losing weight again. And yet she gets this alert every single time.
So I want to speak to that. Yes, absolutely. EMRs, which are electronic medical records, do have a trigger for certain things, obesity, smoking, a few things that they see as, I think what they see as easy interventions, which really aren't easy interventions.
But easy intervention.
What I think that the downfall for this is that if patients are just being seen for 15 minutes by a primary care physician and they have 10 chronic issues, of which obesity is one, that they're getting shortchanged with regards to how they would treat the obesity. And often all they've been ever told in their entire life is just to eat less or exercise more, when we do actually have treatments that work, whether it be the extension into psychology, pharmacotherapy, surgery for the treatment of obesity. But they have never been recommended those things. For example, we know that only 1% of patients in the United States that meet criteria for severe obesity actually undergo weight loss surgery, which we know to be the by far the most effective tool to treat severe obesity. So it shows that we do have treatments and tools available that have long-term efficacy that are not being utilized. Now, with regards to coverage of treatment for obesity, we have struggled with this greatly, and we have introduced before Congress the Treat and Reduce Obesity Act, which is we've tried to push through several times. It's currently has several supporters, bipartisan support on both the House and Senate side. And the goal of TROA is to cover both behavioral therapy and pharmacotherapy for the treatment of obesity, because it is so sparse throughout the United States, both with private and public payers.
Oh, interesting. Michael and Dr. Stanford, you can imagine we have a line of callers, because this is such a huge issue. I mean, this is like everyone struggles with their weight, some people more than others. So I want to let these stories in here. So let me just turn to them. Alicia is calling from Abingdon, Virginia. Alicia, you're on the air.
Hi, this is a great conversation. Thank you. I was a fat-shamed child. I grew up in a home where my family served responsible, balanced diet meals, and I was fat and my sisters were not. They called me, my name was Patricia. I've since changed it because that name became so painful, because Pat rhymed with fat and Patsy rhymed with Fatsy, and that's what I was called for many years, and it just even hurts even to say that out loud, but that's true. By the time I was in my 20s, I had dieted and yo-yo dieted back and forth, and the diets didn't work, and I was really, really ill. And finally, I discovered that by combining my food differently, not putting protein with carbohydrates at meals, by getting rid of sugar and alcohol and preservatives, I was able to maintain, restore my health, actually, and maintain a healthy weight. And I've been able to maintain a healthy weight for the last 35 years by doing that.
Wow.
I really pay attention to gut bacteria. And make sure that I keep a healthy internal ecosystem. And I would say that that has really saved my life and eliminated a lot of chronic illnesses, which I had developed by the time I was 28.
Well, Alicia, thank you so much for your call. If you could see us in the studio here, you'd see Dr. Stanford nodding her head vigorously.
Yes. So, Alicia, thanks so much for calling in. I think you bring up a very important point. First of all, I'm so sorry for the shaming that you received your entire life. It sounds like both from peers and from maybe the medical community. So I'd like to apologize, at least on behalf of the medical community. But I think you bring up some good points, something that we had not talked about. For example, we know that there are several different factors that play a role in weight regulation, of which gut microbiome or gut bacteria is one. But I think you bring up something that's also very important, and that is the personalization of the treatment of patients that struggle with weight. You have found what works for you in terms of your carb protein balance, looking at alcohol, looking at different things, and that is great. What I would never do in the office is extrapolate what worked for Alicia to every single other person that comes in my office, recognizing that there's significant variation and that I must personalize the treatment as much as possible. But I'm very happy that you have found something that works for you, and I thank you for taking time to call in.
Michael, did you want to share a thought about Alicia's story?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, weight is the number one reason that children are bullied. And this is one of the other things. I mean, medical practice is one element of what we're getting wrong about the obesity epidemic. But there's all these other factors. And one of them is that bullying for weight is not remotely taken seriously. And it's absolutely appalling that children are still teased for their weight. And then oftentimes told by principals and teachers that they need to lose weight, that they're the problem. And that's terrible. So I'm also really bummed to hear about what happened to Alicia. There's also, I mean, on the individualization thing, I absolutely agree with Fatima. And if you guys could see my inbox since the article came out, you know, there's kind of like, I knew I was going to get the fat shaming kinds of emails, you know, fat people are lazy, boring stuff. But then so much of this weight shaming actually takes place in people saying, oh, they need to try the keto diet. They need to try paleo. They need to do zone. There's this kind of bullying way that Alicia was not doing, but there is a bullying and very human way that people think that what worked for them will work for somebody else. And so you get this kind of this discourse around, oh, well, what they really need to do is cut out calories, or what they really need to do. And this very simplistic advice that's really not helpful. And it's sort of mansplainy to people who, most fat people have tried a million diets by now, and they really don't need to be told calories in, calories out, or whatever boring thing. And so it's very important, I think, for us not to generalize from our own experience when it comes to weight.
Well, when we come back, we're going to take a lot more callers because there are a ton of them. We're talking about maybe somehow figuring out a way to rethink how we approach the obesity epidemic in America. And Michael Hobbs joins us. He's a staff writer at the Huffington Post. He's written about this, and we have a link to his story at onpointradio.org. And Dr. Fatima Cody Stanford joins us as well. She's an obesity specialist at Massachusetts General Hospital. We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about efforts or maybe a call to rethink how we think about the obesity epidemic in America. I'm joined today by Michael Hobbs. He's a staff writer at Huffington Post, and he wrote an article called Everything You Know About Obesity is Wrong. And also with us is Dr. Fatima Cody Stanford. She's an obesity medicine physician at Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Stanford and Michael, so many callers, so I just want to let people have their say. Let's go to Seth, who's calling from Johnson City, Tennessee. You're on the air, Seth.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I just kind of wanted to talk about something that Michael brought up near the beginning of the episode, where he talked about the way that his mom was treated kind of by her friends and then kind of her behavior at home. I think it's really interesting because I've struggled with my weight my entire life, but I've never really let my weight hold me back. It always seems to be the prejudiced reactions, kind of the stigma and things like that that I get from other people that really hold me back. So Johnson City, Tennessee is a huge area. Outdoors activities are giant. So I'm always very active. However, there have been several times in my entire life where I just don't get included in things because people think that my weight will hold them back.
Uh-huh.
So it's kind of interesting that it doesn't just affect me, but it also affects my relationships kind of very broadly.
Yeah. Well, Seth, thank you for your call, and thank you for sharing your story. I want to get Cindy in here, who's calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Cindy, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I have 2 points. One is about the definition of obesity. I am a very muscular, very active 5'12", and when I get on the scale, I am, air quotes, obese. So The very definition of obesity takes into account the number on the scale and my height.
Right, for your BMI. Right.
Right. So that's frustrating. That's one point. The more important one, I think, is that I never hear anyone talk about what is underlying the eating behavior. So, you know, as a society, we treat symptoms, not causes. I know so many very obese women who are just absolute caretakers. They're running a school. They've got foster kids. They're caring for everybody. No time for themselves. they were unloved themselves as children. So the food is a substitute for love, for closeness, and for personal caretaking. And I never hear, not never, but I very rarely hear anyone talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a solution for obesity is treating the needs that people are meeting with food.
Cindy, let me just jump in here. Thank you for your call, because Dr. Stanford, go ahead.
Yeah, so Cindy, I want to address a few points. Thanks so much for calling in. Number one, you talked about BMI, which is what the World Health Organization uses for obesity. And I would say definitely there are some challenges with that. I can tell you that with each patient that I see, I pay attention to the weight and height, but I pay very close attention to weight distribution. So central adiposity, meaning weight that's carried in that midsection, is of most concern, because that does predispose patients to heart disease and other illnesses such as fatty liver. So I would say that if for someone like yourself who seems to be more muscular, where the BMI would not be necessarily the best criteria, I would pay attention to that waist circumference, targeting a waist circumference of 35 inches or less. And we do have significant studies based upon the ATP3 guidelines that support that. With regards to the psychology, actually, if you look at Michael Hobbs' article, he specifically did interview psychologist Dr. Stephanie Sogg from the MGH Weight Center was interviewed, and we do have all of our patients spend time with the psychologist, delving to issues such as what is the psychology behind their eating behaviors, but not just their eating behaviors, because of course that's the accusatory part, understanding what has been their struggle surrounding weight during the course of their life. So I do think that that's a very important piece. We have several psychologists like Dr. Sogg working on this, and so I would say that we do pay attention to that, and I think Michael Hobbs did do a good job by bringing those voices into the article.
So I want to just switch gears here for a second and take a step back. And Michael, I'll bring you back in here for this as well. Because Dr. Stanford, I've heard you a couple of times in this conversation, you know, call especially extreme obesity a disease state, implying that it's not a normal state. Now, for some people, sort of a higher than average weight might be their normal sort of body set point for their weight. But 50 years ago, 60 years ago, we didn't see the rates of overweight or obese Americans anywhere near what we have now. So, I mean, I don't think anyone's going to say that this epidemic that we're seeing is normal, right? Like,
right.
And so this is such a layperson question, but I want to get your feel for it. And Michael, you too. Is it the food supply? I mean, where did this come from? Is it a mix of the food that we're eating and genetic predispositions or something? Because it does feel like it kind of happened overnight.
Absolutely. I think of this as really, we are in an obesogenic environment. So I call it the perfect storm. What we have is we have had a change in our food quality. We've had a change in our physical activity. We've had a change in the quality and duration of our sleep. We've had a change in circadian rhythm disturbances. What I mean by that is that we are rewarded with being able to talk to our colleagues in Russia and talk to our colleagues in India when we're supposed to be asleep here in the United States.
You're telling me that modernity is terrible for our health.
Yes.
and I say that not jokingly, right?
Yeah,
if you're talking about
true.
Sleep and physical activity and food, and especially for people who, you know, are lower income, getting that high quality food. Michael, you pointed this out. It's like 8 times more expensive than the food that they could get at the corner bodega.
Yeah, I mean, you know, 4% of our agricultural subsidies go to fruits and vegetables. And when we talk to people about this kind of off-brand advice about, oh, eat less and exercise more, that assumes that people have the time to exercise and that their neighborhood has sidewalks and parks where they can go jogging and that they don't have 2 kids and 2 jobs. And a lot of people do. And a lot of people, you know, if you're spending food stamps, what are you going to spend your food stamps on? You're not going to buy broccoli, which is wildly expensive and doesn't feed your kids. You're going to get something really cheap and really easy and frozen and processed and whatever else. And that's, I don't think it's fair to blame people for that. I think we tend to blame our choices without blaming our options. And our options have profoundly changed since 1980. And the choices that we make within those options, I don't think this blaming kind of frame for that really helps very much when it's simply impossible or too expensive for most people to do the things we're always barking at them to do.
Yeah. And so the reason why I wanted to bring this up, Dr. Stanford, is because, I mean, we're talking about rethinking how we approach obesity. And even in that context, this conversation, it's not bad, but I felt this conversation being pulled into sort of, individual responsibility, things that can be done in the clinician's office, et cetera. But in order to really get a handle on this epidemic, we have to look way outside of that.
Absolutely.
Right?
We have to go outside the box. We need to bring together persons in healthcare, persons in, that are policymakers, physical activity facilities, schools, et cetera. I always talk about bringing together all of the people, and that would really be everyone, to the table to make this discussion really shift in a direction where we actually have any dent on obesity rates in both the pediatric and adult population. And I think what we've done with regards to this epidemic is work entirely in silos. Medicine works by itself. Public health works by itself. We come up with food labeling, assuming that that's going to lead to change in obesity rate, and we've seen none of that happen. Look at food deserts and, oh, if we get rid of food deserts, that's going to change everything. No, we need to be coming together, making these decisions together, and really in order to make a shift in a way that's positive for the U.S. and for the world.
Well, let's get another call in here. Raina is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Raina, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I am a primary care doctor in Johnston, Rhode Island, just outside of Providence. And it's a wonderful conversation. I'm outside of my office just nodding my head very enthusiastically about all the comments that people are making. And I had read Michael's article and sent it actually to all the other providers in the office because I think it's such an important concept of how we speak to our patients about this. And I just wanted to comment on the nuances of how you speak to people about this conversation because it's so individualized. So a lot of times I'm trying to frame how I speak to people about focusing on their health and, you know, wanting to care about the quality of food that they're putting in their bodies and the benefits of exercise for how they feel about themselves. And then from the patient side of things, a lot of times people want to lose weight, you know, not just for their health, but they care about how they look and how they feel about themselves. And so trying to help them navigate through that when I know that, you know, most of these diets don't work and trying to find the right plan for them. And it's just a very difficult and very individualized conversation to have with patients.
Well, Raina, thank you for your call. Michael Hobbs, respond to that, because I feel like one of the undercurrents in your article, and please feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, is you're pushing back against if folks have a desire to lose weight in order to look better or feel better. But Raina there is saying that she sees a lot of patients in her office that that's exactly what they want.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth making the distinction between habits and weight, right? That there's a lot of skinny people who don't have particularly great habits, right? We all have that friend who eats a ton and never exercises and they're just genetically or whatever skinny. And so those people would probably need some diet counseling too. And then there's fat people who have been like this their whole lives and are not interested in losing weight, are not interested in having a diet again, and that is fine too. I mean, I think it's really important for doctors to see where patients are and to listen before they're giving any of this advice, and especially not putting them on a diet that's not sustainable. We just had a study last week where doctors in the UK were putting people on an 800 calorie per day diet. That's like prisoner of war camp diet. I mean, that's never going to work in the long term. And those kinds of diets should be completely shunned from any kind of medical practice. They're not useful.
Dr. Stanford, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah. So he's talking about the BMJ article that just came out last week, looking at 12 practices over the UK. You know, I don't like to do this significant severe calorie restriction. I think that he's right with regards to that. I do want to speak to Raina and what she's saying as a primary care physician, that she really does have an interest in working with patients to treat their obesity. But patients can immediately sense whether or not you have a desire to help them or to shame them. And so what I think that patients are getting from Raina, and I appreciate you, Raina, for being a PCP that's committed to this work, she's saying, hey, I'm available. I may not have all the answers, but I'm here to fight this with you.
One more call here, possibly more than one, but let's see what we can do here. Catherine is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. You're on the air, Catherine.
Thanks for having me. I wanted to make the point that I'm in a profession where I sort of see people over a long period of time, sometimes on and off over the years. And one of the things that I think could possibly be really helpful is, and this doesn't count if you've been, you know, overweight since childhood or all your life, but, you know, a lot of men and women begin to gain weight gradually in their sort of middle years, and it builds up, you know, 1 or 2 pounds at a time.
This is the story of my life right now, Catherine.
Yeah. If the medical profession is concerned and could sort of, you know, make helpful comments early on, it would be a lot easier to manage it. And so waiting until people are, you know, dangerously medically obese before making any intervention, I think is counterproductive. There are lots of opportunities to make people aware. You know, a lot of times people think, well, my doctor hasn't said anything, so I'm fine.
Yeah.
But they're not really aware of how much harder it's going to be later if it gets up to be 50, 60, 70 pounds. You know,
Catherine,
10 pounds isn't,
I just want to say thank you for your call. Because, again, this is the only, literally the only drawback of radio is you cannot see the vigorous nodding of heads in the studio here. Dr. Stanford, you are.
Yes, Catherine, thank you so much for your information that you've presented. I think early intervention is key. And once a patient does struggle with their weight, the earlier we intervene, the better our chances are, which is why I work with both pediatric and adult patients. I do want to bring up something that you brought up in the midlife, and I have given lectures specifically on weight gain in the midlife. For women, this is something that is largely hormonal. As we see a shift from a gynoid distribution of fat, which is in that hip, buttock, and thigh region, to more central, or we call an android distribution of fat. And a lot of that is hormone dependent. So the typical person that will seek out care for obesity anywhere in the country, not just in a specific area, is a middle-aged Caucasian woman that may have not struggled with their weight, but then began to struggle in the midlife as we do see these hormonal shifts into peri and postmenopausal. So there are things that they can't necessarily do to intervene early in those situations, but early intervention is key. Getting patients the care they need, the earliest they can potentially get it, is going to be our best treatment strategy.
Let's see if I can slide one more call in here. Jean is calling from North Canton, Ohio. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My doctor tells me that I'm obese, but she's also obese, and I'm really stymied when it comes to losing weight when my doctor doesn't take her own advice.
Well, Jean, thank you for your call. Michael Hobbs, you have a response for her?
Oh, man. There's actually studies on this that fat shaming is a two-way street and discrimination is a two-way street. And so fat doctors are less likely to be believed by their patients on really all of their medical advice. It's really depressing. And I think to me that just shows, first of all, how difficult it is to lose weight in that you've got a medical professional who they're presumably quite educated about the biology and food systems and what is good for them and what's not good for them, and yet they're still a larger person. So this idea that we're going to tell people that, oh, soda is bad for you and magically they're going to be skinnier is just not the case, right? And it also shows the way that we tend to discredit fat people in a lot of different areas of life. We tend not to believe them. We tend not to take them seriously. And it is a real challenge for larger doctors. I've heard from some larger doctors since the article came out that said this is something that just it's an awkward kind of thing that both patient and doctor are aware of, but it's something that neither one of them feel comfortable commenting on.
Mm. Dr. Stanford, go ahead, and then I have one last question for you, but we've only got a minute left.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would like to speak to this. As a physician that is lean, I would say that I do think that patients trust my judgment or maybe take me more seriously, and I don't think that that's what they should be doing. But what I do find that has not been brought up is that for physicians that were able to successfully lose weight, that often patients like that because they feel as though that doctor can empathize with them in a way that I might not be able to as someone that has not struggled with my weight in the same way. Like we said, obesity, the disease process is really challenging, and for us to make assumptions about either the healthcare provider or the patients that are seeing us really is shortchanging what their life story has been.
Well, you know, the last question I had for you was essentially that for people, we talked about how all diets don't work, but nevertheless, for people who it's medically necessary or who want to lose weight, there are lifestyle changes. I mean, working with a doctor,
absolutely,
that they can
achieve. I would say find an obesity medicine physician. We are committed to your care. We are out there and we're building up our ranks.
Well, Dr. Fatima Cody Stanford, obesity medicine physician at Massachusetts General Hospital Weight Center, thank you so much for joining us today. And Michael Hobbs, staff writer at Huffington Post, author of this provocative article, Everything You Know About Obesity Is Wrong. We've got a link to it at onpointradio.org. Michael, it was great to have you. Thank you for getting us thinking.
Thanks. I also have a podcast called You're Wrong About where we cover this as well.
All right. Well, people tune into that podcast as well. I'm out of time. I'm Agnes Chakrabarty. This is On Point.